HPPodCraft.com.
It was past time for him to see the doctor again. Mr. Harris turned palely in at the stairwell, and on his way up the flight saw Dr. Burley's name gilded over a pointing arrow. Would Dr. Burley sigh when he walked in? After all, this would make the 10th trip so far this year. But Burley shouldn't complain. He was paid for the examinations. The nurse looked Mr. Harris over and smiled, a bit amusedly, as she tiptoed to the glazed glass door, opened it, and put her head in. Harris thought he heard her say, "Guess who's here, doctor?" And didn't the doctor's voice reply, faintly, "Oh my God, again?" Harris swallowed uneasily.
That was the opening of the Ray Bradbury short story Skeletor, and we're going to talk about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
No, wait. The story's called Skeleton, like the bones in your body.
Oh, Skeleton.
Yeah, that was the opening of the Ray Bradbury short story Skeleton. And we're going to talk about it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chris Lackey.
And I'm Skeletor. We're here at HPPodCraft.com, Patreon, and Snake Mountain. No, I'm actually Chad Pfeiffer. I did go as Skeletor one Halloween when I was a kid, though. So I feel like I know the man.
Sure.
I was inside of Skeletor. The costume, anyway. I had one of those store-bought costumes for Skeletor.
It's a little plastic mask and the rubber band that goes around the
Exactly. Yeah. And then the costume itself is sort of almost like a tunic you put over your clothes, and it has that really awesome plastic smell.
Yes, I know it well.
Which probably gave us all diseases from smelling it, but it's got that Halloween smell. All of which is irrelevant to this story. Yet another piece of fiction from The October Country.
That's right.
The October Country is an anthology of stories by Mr. Ray Bradbury that we're covering all this month. The stories in The October Country originally appeared in the Arkham House collection Dark Carnival, Bradbury's first published work, and many were published prior to that collection in Weird Tales, so Bradbury is in the company of many of the authors we cover here on the show. I think October Country would also be a good music genre. Kind of gothy country music. Shania and the Banshees kind of thing, I think.
Yeah.
Speaking of music, we're once again joined by reader Eric Peabody,
who read for us
during Harlan Ellison Month. Eric does freelance audio production, including cleanup editing and mixing for voiceover, that's podcasts, audiobooks, etc., mixing and mastering for music projects, and you can find him at vikingguitar.com. We'll link out in the show notes. Remember, Viking Guitar is also the name of Eric's video game cover band. You can find their stuff on YouTube. It's all pretty awesome. And when I explained what the story was about to him, the story Skeleton, he said he found the concept very humorous. Get it? Humorous? Mm-hmm. Like the bone? Humorous? It's a skeleton pun?
This story was first published in Weird Tales, September 1945. This is the same month that World War II ended, and I was reading an article on Tor about this story, maybe relating to someone experiencing some kind of post-war trauma. Mm-hmm. But I gotta admit that I don't really see that in this story. Bradbury was kept out of the war due to his poor eyesight, so he didn't really have any firsthand experience with the war. Mm. Maybe he knew some fellas that came back, recounted that, but I mean, this is right when the war ended, so it seems unlikely to me.
Well, people would have been coming back from the war the whole time, though. I mean, I think, of course, he knew veterans. I think anything written in this period of the 40s is going to be influenced by the war to some extent. You can make connections there. I think that on that Tor article, the connection was, you know, soldiers coming back from wartime maybe feel like they don't fit in, that there's something wrong with them. They can't.
Sure.
You know, and I think maybe that was the connection there. Yeah. And we'll try and make some other ones. I feel like there's broader connections to be made, actually, than something that specific. I don't know if it's overtly about the war, I think is what you're saying. And I agree with you there.
Now, this story, to me, seems like straight-up body horror.
Right, exactly. I think a modern audience can relate to the core of this story just as much as anybody from the 40s. Being freaked out by your own body, it seems like kind of an eternal thing for humans. It's also kind of entertaining because it puts a fine point on the fact that we use skeletons as monsters in media a lot. At one point in here, Bradbury writes, "Skeletons are horrors. They clink and tinkle and rattle in old castles." So it's a trope that people would have known even then.
Sure.
You know, there's lots of reanimated skeletons in films for people to scream and run from. But of course, when you think about it, it's pretty ludicrous because we're all skeletons walking around every day. Mm-hmm. Even in The Karate Kid, the bad guys, you know, Johnny and the other students from Cobra Kai, when they go out for Halloween, it's in those skeleton costumes.
Oh, right, yeah.
And there are some who say that this story is actually Bradbury's reaction to Cobra Kai intimidation strategies. This was him dealing with that issue. No?
I don't know if you got your chronology quite right there, but
maybe I dreamt that. I don't know.
Could be a dream, probably. Yeah, that would make sense.
Let's get into the story and find out.
So the story begins with this guy, Mr. Harris, who seems to be a bit of a hypochondriac. He's complaining to his doctor about his bones aching. And his doctor says, look, I told you, quit smoking, stop eating so much meat, get more sleep. But you didn't listen, so that's fine. That'll be $10.
Right.
You still here? You're a hypochondriac. That's $11 now.
That's the diagnosis. Mr. Harris is saying, but why do my bones ache? And the doctor says, it's just like a sore muscle, man. If you keep messing with it, it's just going to get worse. If you leave it alone, it'll heal up on its own. I have to say, I was relating to Mr. Harris a bit, though, how you can get obsessed in this conversation. You know, you can get obsessed with a weird thing on your body or in your body.
Sure.
And if you keep thinking about it, it can drive you crazy. You know, like my jaw clicks when I open my mouth wide.
Yeah, I do. I've got a clicking jaw as well.
You ever, like, just start paying attention to it and then you can't stop thinking about it? You're opening and closing your mouth and listening for the click.
I did that for a while, and then I got to the point where if I started to think that way, I just stopped it.
Right.
I just had to.
This guy's unable to do that.
No, he can't. Mr. Harris leaves unsatisfied, so he looks in the phone book for another doctor, and he finds a bone specialist named M. Munigant. Now, the guy doesn't seem to have any credentials, so he's not a doctor, but his office is close, and Mr. Harris, he needs something. Munigant is described as a small, dark man. He listens intently as Mr. Harris explains his problem. Munigant explains that bones are complicated, and there are a number of things that it could be.
Yes, it says he'd seen cases like this before. Man was not aware of his bones, but this is some kind of imbalance, an unsympathetic coordination between soul, flesh, and skeleton. And Harris is happy about this. Here's a guy who gets me. He looks around at all the pictures of skeletons on the walls. It says the x-rays and the paintings blew in a green and phosphorescent wind from a land peopled by the monsters of Dali and Fuseli. Which, that was a reference that felt a little Lovecraftian. You know, he's always comparing things to paintings. And But this Munigant seems to be the guy who can help.
He has a treatment if Mr. Harris is ready to receive said treatment.
Yes, he puts emphasis on the fact that Mr. Harris has to be ready for the treatment. Psychologically, one has to need help or the doctor is useless. It's basically what he says. And that seemed a little like, and maybe this is a simple reading of the metaphor, but this guy's issue with the skeleton is it could be a metaphor for any mental issue or addiction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite the same as, you know, whether you believe you have a broken leg or not. If they set the leg, it's going to heal. Whereas with other things that are more psychological in nature, you can get help, but success is dependent on the patient really wanting to be rid of whatever the issue is. So if you're not in the mental place where you'll do whatever you need to do to get better, then you can't be helped no matter what people try to do. And this seemed like that to me. Does the skeleton represent any issue or secret that one can't reconcile themselves with, whether it's sexuality, gender, addiction, an inability to keep up with life or fit in because there's this central internal issue you're preoccupied with all the time.
Mm.
It's internal that you're struggling with. And it feels a lot like that to me. Could be a simple, simplistic reading of it.
Munigant has Mr. Harris lie down and open his mouth. The lights are switched off and the blinds are drawn in the room. He feels something touch his tongue.
He felt his jawbones forced out. They creaked and made faint, cracking noises. One of those skeleton charts on the dim wall seemed to quiver and jump. A violent shudder seized Harris. Involuntarily, his mouth snapped shut.
Munigant pulls back quickly, and then he just says, you know what, this is no use. You're not ready for the treatment. He gives a sketch of the human body showing a skeleton inside of it to Mr. Harris for him to study and try to understand. It says, skeletons are strange, unwieldy things. M. Munigant's eyes glittered. Good day to Mr. Harris. Oh, and would he care for a breadstick? M. Munigant proffered a jar of long, hard, salty breadsticks to Harris, taking one himself, saying that chewing breadsticks kept him in practice. Good day to Mr. Harris.
So what were you thinking about Munigant at this point?
I just thought he was some weird dude.
The breadsticks trigger anything for you?
No, it didn't. I have to say I didn't catch that.
I didn't either.
Oh, good. Okay, good.
Yeah, no. I knowing how this ends now when you look back.
Sure.
I mean, I thought maybe he was just moonlighting after a shift at the Olive Garden or something like that. That's the reason he had all these breadsticks. But there is something in this interaction that's predatory as well, you know, where he tries to do something that's maybe violating Mr. Harris a little bit. Harris reacts negatively and pushes him back. And then he puts the blame on the patient. Oh, you're not ready for this yet.
Yeah.
That's very predatory. The issue's with you. What I was doing was fine. You're the one that's not ready.
So Mr. Harris goes home to his wife, Clarice, and they have dinner. Little is said, but she cracks her knuckles, and this causes him to yell at her to stop. The rest of the afternoon, he spends in his room while Clarice hangs out playing bridge with some of her friends in the other room. He's troubled and he calls to her. She comes in very sweetly and sits on his lap. He slides her kneecap around and worries, asks her, is it supposed to be like this?
I get that feeling. When you do, this thing's just floating around in here, my kneecap. You know, I would guess that past whatever wartime or illness metaphor we could make out of this, the inspiration probably just came down to Bradbury going through this exact experience. You know, feeling weird about a skeleton here and there. Thinking, what if somebody really had a problem with this?
Oh, sure.
I think that's the jumping off point. And then it becomes a metaphor for something. But I just feel like he went, oh, man, this is weird. My kneecap, I can kind of push it around in here. That's odd.
If you think about your body and how you've got, you know, there's hard bits and soft bits, and then there's squishy bits. And if it hurts if you touch one part, but it doesn't hurt if you touch this other part. And, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a mystery what goes on in your body and all the functions of it. You know, like, I get gas. I'm a vegetarian, so I'm farting all over the place most of the time. And, you know, I'm still like, God, what is the one thing? Because it's not consistent. So there's something in my diet that causes me to fart. I'm not exactly sure what it is. But it's frustrating, and I can see that this is kind of an extrapolation on that concept. So there's part of your body that's doing stuff that you don't necessarily like or doesn't feel right.
Sure.
And that's something that's very relatable. So about the knee, she says, of course, this is normal. And then he pokes at his own rib and he goes, this one's kind of moving around. She's like, look, everybody has those.
Yeah.
She's being sweet, though. She's like understanding of his problem. And he thanks her. And they both genuinely seem to care for each other. So then she returns to her game.
Yeah, I had a hard time figuring out just how aware she was of his panic, which she calls his brooding.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's really at the beginning of this mania. Like, it's maybe something that was bugging him for a while, but we're really seeing it ramp up. It could be that he's really just struggling with this internally and he's not giving up much to her. But the fact that she knows everything, I mean, she seems ready to go with some skeleton facts throughout the story.
Sure.
You know, I liked this. He put his finger to touch his nose and hers. Did you realize the nose bone grows down only this far? From there on, a lot of gristly tissue fills out the rest. Of course, darling, she says. And she danced from the room. I'm not sure how much she knows, if she's just trying to downplay it as a means to help him downplay it.
Hmm.
I do remember, I know that sensation, though. I remember seeing a skull for the first time and wondering where the nose bone was, you know, when it suddenly ends and there's a hole there.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So sitting alone, he feels his body and he ponders the way it feels, and then he starts freaking out about it.
His teeth began to chatter. God almighty, he thought. Why haven't I realized it all these years? All these years I've gone around with the skeleton inside me. How's it we take ourselves for granted? How's it we never question our bodies and our being?
Again, this is classic body horror stuff, but people have parts of their body that they don't like or feel that don't belong. Your body turning against you, just like you said at the top. Mm-hmm. Now, there is something called body dysmorphia, which on the acceptable end of it, people have issues with their body and you can change some things. So that's like cosmetic surgery or gender reassignment. But for some people, it goes much deeper. And there's specifically this thing called body integrity identity disorder. Now here, this is where people feel like they shouldn't have whole body parts. Like they want to remove their arms or their legs or their fingers. I mean, I think we even talked about smoothies at one point on this show.
Right.
Those are people that want to remove all of their body hair, and some people want to remove their fingernails and toenails and things like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, having your arm or leg removed is illegal in most places. You won't find a doctor to do it unless it's like a crooked doctor somewhere.
Yeah.
And there's many reports of people going down to Tijuana, getting the surgery done, then getting gangrene. And again, part of this is that there is even more complex psychological issues with it, where the people want to be disabled. Mm. And then there's parts of this this body integrity identity disorder where they will pretend to be disabled. And then there are other people that are attracted to it and sexually attracted to being disabled or having a missing limb. I remember that movie Crash. Do you remember that? There was whole group of fetishists that were into people that were in accidents and had lost limbs or had amputations.
Right. James Spader Crash, not the one that won the Oscar years later.
Right. Yeah. Yes. That's right. Yeah. I remember that one came out later and was like, what, that James Spader movie? Like, no, it's a totally, totally different one.
Yeah.
But of course, this is a very large rabbit hole and I only skimmed the surface of this and I'm not really able to speak with any authority on it. So hopefully I haven't offended anybody or got anything wrong
with that. No, I don't think so. But no, I think it's, look, that you can take this as a metaphor for other issues, or you could take it, this is a direct issue that maybe somebody even has now where they feel like their skeleton isn't part of their body, or they feel like parts of their body aren't their own. I mean, people are weirded out by their own bodies all the time, even just getting older, you know?
Oh my
the
God,
changes yeah. that happen. It's a strange experience being a ghost in a meat shell.
It's true. So he freaks out a while on this. And I got to say, this is the point in the story where it was losing me. Kind of just going over and over this idea that he's got a skeleton in his body. And that is a lot of the story. And I dig Bradbury because he always ties up motion into his stories. I mean, we're talking about the sentimentality of his writing style, which is something I like because I connect to them. But in this one, I just don't connect.
I get that. I mean, I felt like the level of obsession is somewhat revealed in the repetition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually enjoyed this story. This didn't bother me. It's repetitive in content, maybe. Oh my God, there's a skeleton in there. But the writing is always fresh, and he finds new ways to obsess about the same issue. This is the part where he says, inside my head is a skull, one of those curved carapaces which holds my brain like an electric jelly, one of those cracked shells with the holes in front like two holes shot through it by a double-barreled shotgun, a skull encompassing my brain, allowing an exit through its brittle windows to see the outside world. So each time he obsesses about it, he obsesses about a different thing, and then I like the way that he explicates it. I can understand why it might have bored you for some reason, and it may be because I have an obsessive mind. I was relating to this.
It could be.
I was, you know.
Could be.
It's a guy at war with himself, and that's just something that I feel like I understand, so I connect to it.
His wife calls him in to meet the girls, and he does, but he is so upset about his skeleton revelation that he just runs out and he throws up in the flower bed.
I think the part that really freaks him out when he's talking to these ladies, it's that their skeletons show themselves whenever they talk or eat, because that's when you see teeth. So every time he sees their teeth, he goes, I'm seeing their skeleton. Ah, bleh. Throws up in the flower bed.
So that night in bed with his wife, Mr. Harris wonders about his fingernails. But his wife explains they're just hardened epidermis. She can see that he's troubled, but he won't share with her the extent of his problem. So at work the next day, Mr. Harris starts asking his coworkers if he can feel certain bones on their bodies. They do, generally, but then he asks Miss Laurel to touch her shoulder blades, and she immediately pushes herself back against him, purring like a kitten and shutting her eyes. Miss Laurel, he snapped, stop that.
She was into it.
Yeah.
It was the one time sexual harassment actually worked, and he doesn't even want it.
Yeah, he wasn't trying to sexually harass her. He really was curious about her bones.
Yeah.
And then...
Boy, I remember during the Anita Hill trial, Ray Bradbury was pretty flippant over the idea of sexual harassment. A lot of people were talking about it. It was a somewhat new concept in pop culture.
Oh.
I remember he said, I sexually harassed my wife for a year, and then she married me. You know, he saw sexual harassment as a form of... courtship.
Yeah.
He would be really having a lot of trouble in the current environment because Ray Bradbury really loathed political correctness and was pretty outspoken about that fact. Mm-hmm. Some issues he was left-wing on, some he was right-wing on, but he really hated it when societally we were told what we could think or say or do. I just think he'd really be upset these days by entertainers being, you know, quote-unquote canceled.
Oh, right.
By saying that, I'm not trying to get Bradbury canceled. I mean, you could find stuff in any author's background that's going to be like, I don't agree with that. Because he was really flippant about certain things, specifically around that issue. He said some stuff that I think would really get him in a lot of trouble these days.
Well, thankfully, we have no experience with controversial writers.
No, none at all. Now, the war is referenced here. Alone, he pondered his neuroses. The war was just over. The pressure of his work, the uncertainty of the future, probably had much to do with his mental outlook. So the story is aware that the war has just ended.
So Mr. Harris isn't happy with his job. He's considering leaving and becoming a potter. He wants to move to Arizona, set up shop there. He figured that this feeling is going to pass eventually, that his bones don't belong in his body.
Yeah, he's not going to go back to a doctor. He can do all of this on his own.
But the feeling only grows stronger. He goes on and on about the battle of bones and flesh until he realizes that he controls the bones, that they are slaves to his muscles and blood. But in the end, he still is deeply troubled, obviously.
Yeah.
So at the end of the week, he weighs himself and he sees that he's lost 10 pounds. That's flesh weight. And he's thinking to himself, I'm losing to the bones. It's time to eat. So he runs to the cafeteria, making sure not to eat things that would strengthen his bones. So things that have high calcium in them and things like that.
No milk for him.
His wife notices that he's losing some weight and she likes the slimmer version of him.
He sees the skeleton as another entity. At this point, it's an enemy. It actually is acting against him. It's not just something he's disassociated with. Because he says, you mean to say you like him better than you like me? So it's actually, he's given it an identity that's completely different from his own.
Now she can tell that he's off and pleads with him to go see a psychiatrist. I can tell you that you and your skeleton are one and the same. One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. United you stand, divided you fall. If you two fellows can't get along like an old married couple in the future, go back and see Dr. Burley. And that was the doctor from the very beginning that told him he's a hypochondriac. Later in the day, Mr. Harris decides he's going to go to Mudigan's office. And when he sees the name on the door, his bones erupt in pain. And then he moves away and the pain stops. It seems like maybe his bones are afraid of Mudigant and will fight to keep him away from him.
Yeah, very weird. It says, could M. Mudigant be using him for some nefarious purpose? But what purpose? Silly to suspect him, just a little doctor.
Thinking about this in hindsight, after getting to the end of the story, I wonder if there's something to that.
Yeah,
if it's
me
not,
too.
If it's not him being a hypochondriac, but there's actually some kind of sense of things.
Totally. Yeah, let's talk about that at the end. I wanted that as well.
Mr. Harris goes to a cocktail bar to try and sort out this whole Mudigant thing when he sees this happy-looking fat guy. He knows that's a guy who's in control of his bones. So he awkwardly goes up to the man and he asks him how he got so fat. But the guy just thinks that Mr. Harris is a drunk and he thinks it's funny. So he's like, hey, come talk to me. And he explains that if you want to get fat, what you got to do is get a terrible wife and a horrible job. And you will find that eating is the only true joy.
20 years, man and boy, I built this. It was no overnight circus. That whole section is funny and I can relate to that, unfortunately.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Too many people in this world haven't enough to worry about and they begin picking on themselves and they lose weight. Meet all the vile, terrible people you can possibly meet and pretty soon you'll be adding the good old fat.
That's such an interesting spin because most body hatred that people have actually comes from their weight. And here you have a person who loves it. You know, he's happy about it.
So Mr. Harris decides it's time to go to Phoenix.
Right. He's going to go to Phoenix, talk to this investor about his ceramics business he wants to start.
He's driving from Los Angeles to Phoenix. It's super hot as he goes through the desert. On a curve, the inside of Mr. H suddenly constricted the outer flesh, causing him to jerk forward on the hot steering wheel. The car plunged off the road into the boiling sand and turned half over.
So his skeleton makes him have an accident. You know, he's just been suspicious of it up to this point, but this is the first time the skeleton has done something independent and dangerous to hurt him.
He's out of it, and he pulls himself out of the car and begins to kind of wander around. And by the time he's in his right head, he is out in the middle of the desert somewhere, and he doesn't know where he is. And he sees vultures circling above him, and he thinks, oh, this was the skeleton's plot. Sun, cook my flesh off so you can peek out. Vultures lunch off me, and there you'll lie, grinning with victory, like a bleached xylophone strewn and played by vultures with an ear for odd music. You'd like that. Freedom. Mm. So he finally collapses from the heat and lack of water. Lying on the ground, he hears a voice call to him. It's a cop. He's been rescued. His car is fixed, and he goes on to Phoenix.
He has this meeting with his investor, and it's successful, even though he's faking his way through it as they have the meeting. He gets his money, but he doesn't even care that he got money for this business. But he gets it, and he starts to return to Los Angeles, avoiding the desert route because he doesn't want to play into the skeleton's hands.
Yes.
Yeah. The car crash was pretty much hitting bottom. He knows, okay, the skeleton's going to kill me if I'm not careful, so I have to actually deal with this problem now.
So he returns home, and his wife sees that he looks sad, and she thinks that the business deal fell through, but he's like, no, it worked. And then she's like, oh, great, yay!
Yeah, and he fakes being cheery with her, but he knows he's got to take action. He keeps picking up the phone to call Mudigant, but hanging up again, nervous.
So she leaves to work at the Red Cross, and we'll be back in a few hours. Mr. Harris decides that he's going to call Mudigant.
He's finally going to do it. And then after he does, he makes the call, he hangs up, and his bones go crazy in his body, assaulting him, like they're anxious.
So Mudigant makes a house call, and Mr. Harris is in such a state that Mudigant can tell that he's not well. And that's when Mr. Harris notices that he sort of whistles when he talks.
Yeah, well, he had noticed it before up at when he first met him, but he assumed it was due to maybe dentures that weren't fitted quite well. But now he's really picking up on the sound. It's pretty pronounced.
So the more Mudigant talks to him about his condition, the more he notices this whistling until finally, your tongue, round, tube-like, hollow?
Yeah.
So he's got a hollow tongue? Mr. Harris thinks he's delirious at this point. That doesn't make any sense. It's bizarre. And Mudigant agrees that his skeleton is betraying him. And Mudigant says that Harris is now ready, but he must give himself over to the treatment. And Harris is like, yeah, I'll do whatever. I'm ready. So Mudigant lays him down and has him open his mouth. And the whistling becomes high and shrill.
Harris felt his jaw pressed violently in all directions. His tongue depressed as with a spoon. His throat clogged. He gasped for breath. Whistle. He couldn't breathe. Something squirmed, corkscrewed his cheeks out, bursting his jaws. Like a hot water douche, something squirted into his sinuses. His ears clanged. Shrieked Harris, gagging. His head, its carapaces riven, shattered, hung loose. Agony shot fire through his lungs. Harris could breathe again, momentarily. His watery eyes sprang wide. He shouted. His ribs, like sticks picked up and bundled, were loosened in him. Pain. He fell to the floor, wheezing out his hot breath.
I think "like a hot water douche" was an original lyric in the Beatles song Dig It, but they cut that out. Kind of sounds disgusting. Anyway.
That's a fun fact. Harris felt his limbs cast loose and free, and the room was empty. He called for Moonaghan, but he's just gone. So he called for help, but there was no reply.
The room is empty. And then he hears something. Deep down in the subterranean fissures of his body, the minute, unbelievable noises. Little smackings and twistings and little dry chippings and grindings and nuzzling sounds. Like a tiny hungry mouse down in the red-blooded dimness, gnawing ever so earnestly and expertly at what might have been, but was not, a submerged timber. So I don't know what crazy process is happening. And then we cut away to Clarice. Mm-hmm. She's walking back from a Red Cross meeting, and she almost runs into this little man who smells of iodine. Obviously, it's Moonaghan. Says he took something long, white, and oddly familiar from his coat and proceeded to chew on it, as on a peppermint stick. Its end devoured, his extraordinary tongue darted within the white confection, sucking out the filling, making contented noises. He was still crunching his goody as she proceeded up the sidewalk to her house.
So Clarice walks inside and calls out to Mr. Harris.
"Darling," she called, smiling around. "Darling, where are you?" She shut the door, walked down the hall and into the living room. "Darling." She stared at the floor for 20 seconds, trying to understand. She screamed. Outside, in the sycamore darkness, the little man pierced a long white stick with intermittent holes. Then, softly, sighing, his lips puckered, played a little sad tune upon the improvised instrument to accompany the shrill and awful singing of Clarice's voice as she stood in the living room. Many times as a little girl, Clarice had run on the beach sands, stepped on a jellyfish, and screamed. It was not so bad finding an intact gelatin-skinned jellyfish in one's living room. One could step back from it. It was when the jellyfish called you by name.
And that's the end of the story.
Oh, it's Moonaghan's a bone-eating monster of some kind.
Yeah.
And then Harris here becomes one of the men without bones.
Well,
how about that? I'm glad we read that story because now I know there's a community for him. He had a skeleton removed, the problem's solved, and there's a group of people that he can go hang out with. Where was that, down in the Amazon or something?
Yeah. He'll find that community. It'll be fine.
He'll find him. Maybe the issue with the skeleton was in relation to the monster. Did he sense that he was going to be preyed upon?
That's what I wonder. And then it's a little strange. Another issue I have with this story is that the whole body horror stuff seems to be separate from this monster that eats bones. And there's like maybe a little bit of connection to it, but not enough that makes it... It feels like two stories got stuck together to me.
I'll agree with you there. I mean, it's one... You have a bone-eating doctor, and then you have a guy who's afraid of his own skeleton, and it feels like it should be about one or the other.
Yeah.
I was pretty surprised when this is how it came to an end, that the guy just ate all of his bones.
I liked that, personally, but it is a little against Wells' law here.
Well, a little, unless the connection you make is that this guy had a issue that was internal, that was messing him up, that was making him feel like he couldn't fit in, and he refused help, and then he finally gave himself up to whatever he needed to give himself up to, and at the end, his problem's been removed, you know?
Sure.
So there, within the metaphor, it's not necessarily that odd. This is somewhat of a happy ending for Mr. Harris, and the skeleton is gone.
Or maybe there was some kind of implication that when he first went to visit Moonaghan, that he did something to him to make his bones kind of revolt in a way, but...
No, I don't think so, because he already was having the issue.
But it wasn't as pronounced. He just had kind of sore bones.
Yeah.
And he has a full-on revolt, you know, like after he visits Moonaghan. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that was maybe the intent and it was just too subtle, or it just doesn't quite sit with me, this story.
I hear you, man. I understand those concerns. For me, it totally worked.
Yeah.
Even with the strange ending and these two things coming together, I thought, well, that's crazy, and kind of enjoyed it. And I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, a person at conflict with themselves who is despising certain elements of their own body or their own personality, these kinds of things click with me. I don't know why.
Sure.
And so I was on board for the obsessive ride. This was adapted for Ray Bradbury Theater. And I haven't seen it. It's got Eugene Levy plays Mr. Harris.
Oh, wow.
And I would be really interested to see how, in the TV adaptation, how this concluded. If the doctor climbs into his mouth and goes in there and eats up on all of his bones. Because I'm not sure what happened, you know?
Yeah,
he's gone from the room, and then he feels all this stuff happening within him. And then we see Mutagon out on the street. So did he jump in there and pull his whole skeleton out or eat it all up, and he's just got one piece left? I mean, I don't really know what happened. So I'd be interested to see the adaptation. That's the story, the skeleton. Sorry you didn't like this one as much. We've got a really good one, or at least I think a really good one, coming up next week. It's The Lake. I know that Bradbury felt like this was his first great story, The Lake.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So we'll see if you agree with that one.
I will.
And then
we will.
After that, we have Jack in the Box, which is another one from this collection, which is a pretty strange one that I also really like. So that's all we have for this week. I want to thank our reader once again, Eric Peabody. Don't forget to go check out VikingGuitar.com if you have any audio production needs, and also check out Viking Guitar on YouTube to see some awesome video game music covers.
Yeah.
That's not the only person I want to thank. I want to thank a bunch of our patrons right now.
Oh my God, do I want to thank them, and how?
I'm going to start by thanking Giorno Giovanni.
I'd like to thank Nick Sarah.
I want to thank Jenny Franklin.
I'd like to thank John Bladdock.
Thank you, Justin Horner.
I'd like to thank Brandon Recky.
Thomas Thurell, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Kyle Kernozik.
A. Neiman, thank you so much.
Lastly, Celestial.
Ooh.
I like that one.
Fancy one name. Thanks, Celestial. Well, that's all we got for this week. We'll be back with more October Country soon. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com and Snake Mountain.
hppodcraft.com.